Welcome to International Edition, where we take a closer look at stories of the day, social media, and much more. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, looking at the fight against ISIS in Iraq, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Some creatures just don't need a mate. Developing a slithering robotic probe.
It started when they noticed that the Sidewinder rattlesnake has a very peculiar way and very efficient way of moving over sand.
And getting a second chance at the coffee shop. It's all ahead here on The Voice of America. Top officials from France, Iraq, and the United States met today in Paris to discuss the anti-Islamic State coalition in Iraq. VOA's Jeffrey Young has been looking into the situation and joins me here in the studio. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Susan.
Jeff, what have you found?
I was just on the phone with Ben Berry at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, and I asked him for his reaction to Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken's comment after the Paris meeting saying the U.S. and its partners have a winning strategy.
Well, the strategy hasn't won yet. It is fair to say that it has helped contain ISIS in Iraq. But just as much of the containment of Iraq, of ISIS was achieved by the mass mobilization of militias, mostly Shia and mostly supported, trained and advised by Iran. It is not clear, in my view, that ISIS is fully contained in Syria. Indeed, its recent successful attack on Palmyra suggests that it isn't.
Ahead of the Paris meeting, the Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi said that the successes by the Islamic State in Iraq represent what he calls a failure of the world. Is that, in your estimation, just rhetoric designed to shift the blame and try to secure some additional assistance? Or has the world indeed failed?
Well, there are two causes to the rise of ISIS. The first one is the damage inflicted on Iraq by the aftermath of the U.S.-led coalition operation to depose Saddam Hussein, and the many blunders that were made shortly thereafter in terms of failure to stabilize and rapidly reconstruct Iraq, as some unfortunate political judgments that were made. It is clear, though, that by 2008, al-Qaeda in Iraq was on the ropes as a result of the U.S. surge in the building capacity of the Iraqi security forces. However, the fruits of that victory were effectively squandered by Prime Minister Maliki in two ways. First of all, his increasingly sectarian behavior disenfranchised the Sunnis and sowed the seed of them giving support to ISIS. And secondly, again, under Prime Minister Maliki's leadership, the effectiveness of the Iraqi security forces was greatly reduced by the toleration of endemic corruption and also the replacement of competent leaders by placemen and political cronies. So I would say that Prime Minister Maliki's statement is a gross oversimplification.
Finally, what would you think it will take to get the Sunni tribes in Anbar and elsewhere in Iraq to join up in the fight and oppose the Islamic State?
Well, this is the sense of gravity of the conflict in Iraq. They've got to think that they should stop supporting ISIS and at least tolerate, if not actively support, the actions of the Iraqi government. Now, bearing in mind those things I've just described, this is going to be a very hard ask. But ultimately, it's only the Iraqi government that can change the situation on the ground. Whether there is more that the U.S. and its allies can do would be a very good question for the conference. But there's little that I've seen on being done by the Iraqi government to significantly help change this balance, which, as I said, is really the center of gravity of the conflict in Iraq.
That was Ben Berry at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London.
Well, thanks, Jeffrey, for sharing that.
Thank you, Susan.
You're tuned to VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. I'm Rick Pantaleo. This may put a bit of a dent in the ego of our male listeners, but did you know that certain female animals living in captivity, such as birds, reptiles, and sharks, have been known to reproduce without any help whatsoever from a male mate? Years ago, scientists found that the offspring produced without any male intervention were the result of an asexual reproductive process called parthenogenesis, or virgin birth. Until now, scientists weren't sure if this form of reproduction was possible with animals that lived in the wild. But now a team of researchers say they have found the first evidence that this form of asexual reproduction indeed does take place with vertebrate animals in the wild. The scientists say that their research shows that around 3% of a species of fish called sawfish living in an estuary in Florida were born as the result of the parthenogenesis form of reproduction. And that's your science in a minute.
The World Health Organization says almost 2,000 people have been killed and 8,000 injured so far in the conflict in Yemen, with innocent civilians paying the highest price. Rana Sadani is the Senior Communications Officer for the WHO Regional Office in Cairo, Egypt, and she joins us on the line. Welcome, Rana.
Thank you.
What can you tell us about the situation in Yemen?
The situation is really very worrying. Many people are losing their lives every day. We are very worried about the health system and the sustainability of the health system. The people who are suffering most are women and children, because there are more than 500,000 of displaced who were forced to flee the violence to neighboring governorate, and most of those displaced are women and children who need urgent care, especially those women who are pregnant and children who are malnourished.
What about the hospitals in Yemen? Are they overrun?
Hospitals around the country are closing down their emergency operations room and intensive care unit due to shortages in staff and fuel for generator. That's why WHO is working with partners to support all the health needs, especially through mobile clinic that can reach the people if there is a need. In addition to this, there are a huge shortage of medicine for diabetes, for hypertension, cancer. All of these medicines are no longer available. And we are noticing a spread of communicable diseases such as malaria and dengue fever, and we are very worried about outbreaks of polio and measles that are also a serious risk.
You mentioned the women and the children. What are they doing? How are they surviving?
Well, many of them live in public schools where you have hundreds of people living in overcrowded rooms, and they share one or two washroom per gender, which is really worrying, because this might increase the possibility of communicable diseases such as measles, for example.
What can be done?
Well, first of all, the health system need to continue functioning. The health staff need to be able to report to their work, and the medicines and the medical supplies need to be, we need to be able to dispatch these medicines and supplies to all affected governorates where they are needed most. And most importantly, all parties to the conflict need to respect the integrity of the health system. There are a lot of attacks against health premises, ambulances, medical personnel. All of this constitutes a violation of the international humanitarian law. That's why the WHO called all the parties to the conflict to stop the attack against the health system and the personnel and vehicle in order to save the lives of innocent people.
So you're saying that they're actually targeting medical people who are trying to help others?
Yes, indeed. And many, many doctors and nurses lost their own lives when they were trying to help and save others.
Well, thank you, Rana, for speaking with us today and sharing this.
Thank you.
The U.S. Senate has been making some progress in trying to pass a bill that would renew a domestic surveillance program that expired on Sunday. Reporter Michael Lippin joins me now in the studio to give us an update on that and what people are saying about the issue on social media. Michael?
Thanks, Susan. Well, the featured story on voanews.com right now is Senate correspondent Michael Bowman's latest piece on the efforts by lawmakers to renew that surveillance program. Michael Bowman's story is titled Surveillance Bill Clears Senate Hurdle. And in that story, he explains how a large majority of senators voted today to speed up the process of putting that bill to a final vote. I'd like to actually turn our attention to another breaking story that has just crossed the wires, and that is the resignation of FIFA's president, Sepp Blatter. Now, Blatter has announced that he will be standing down as president of FIFA a week after scandal engulfed football's world governing body. Blatter has been president since 1998. He won a fifth term as the head of FIFA in last week's elections. Today, Blatter announced that there would be an extraordinary Congress of FIFA to elect a new candidate to fill the role. Another FIFA official, Domenico Scala, said that there. He later announced details of the process to replace FIFA's president, and he also announced future changes to the organization. Scala said that existing FIFA rules require a certain period for elections to be held and for candidates to present themselves. So that means a FIFA presidential election won't take place until at least December this year. Now, Twitter is exploding with interest on this development. Analytics website Topsy shows that Blatter's name has been tweeted at least 230,000 times in just the last hour.
That's really amazing. But, you know, this is such a surprise to many of us.
It is a surprise. It only comes a few days after Sepp Blatter was reelected.
Yeah.
There has been a lot of pressure on him in the last few days to resign, given the recent arrest of FIFA executive committee members. We'll have to find out the next couple of days what exactly led Blatter to resign, despite him insisting after he was reelected that he would stay on.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Michael. Reporter Michael Lippin. Coming up on International Edition, a slithering robot comes to the rescue, and youths try to reclaim their lives. A robot being developed at Carnegie Mellon University has evolved into something of a multi-legged, modular, mechanical snake. It will slither over rugged surfaces and explore its surroundings. Sounds a little scary. VOA's George Putich has been following the story and joins us here in the studio. Welcome, George.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you. Well, tell us about this thing.
I have to go back a little bit. Scientists at Carnegie Mellon University have been experimenting with the snake-like robots for a while. It started when they noticed that the sidewinder rattlesnake
lives in Texas,
has a very peculiar way and very efficient way of moving over sand. And they studied the snakes at the Atlanta Zoo.
It kind of goes sideways and lifts
yes,
its body up in
correct,
the air as it moves.
Correct. And they tried to emulate it with machine. So after a lot of experimenting, they finally designed a machine that can move like a rattlesnake. And you can only imagine how useful such a machine could be, exploring crevices, moving under rubble, you know, search and rescue operations, maybe nuclear power plants. And it's still in development, but mm-hmm. it looks great. And maybe I should try to explain how it looks.
Yes,
if you imagine your wrist, right, is very movable, right? And imagine if you could attach several wrists
together.
To each other,
mm-hmm.
together, and control them with a remote control. Such a device could be very, very useful, right? So this is how the snake moves. And now the next stage of development, they realize that if they take six short snakes and attach them to a box and create sort of an insect, right?
Mm-hmm.
That could also be useful because all of those legs are very movable. They're independent of each other, but can be controlled. So, you know, the experimenting is going on, and it's just, where your imagination leads you.
Yes. I presume this would have a camera on it or several cameras?
Yes, yes. The head of the snake, as they call it, has a camera and lights, of course.
It must be very sturdy if it's going to do
all this.
It's
very sturdy. It can be thrown about and it can easily recover. It does not have sort of up or down, the snake can be turned any way and can be still moving. The only downside of this robot is that it has to trail a cable with controls and, of course, power.
Well, maybe one day they'll get over that hurdle, too, and be able to have it without it.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Well, you just mentioned it might be used for going to disaster sites. Could you tell us a little bit more about how they could use it?
Yes. Actually, they tested their snake robot in an abandoned, never-used nuclear plant in Austria.
Oh.
And the snake went into it's very good going over obstacles and around corners. So the snake went full 18 meters, which is a lot, into some pipes that were all twisted, and it came out fine. And when it was inside, it sent excellent video of the surroundings. So, it's obvious that it can be very useful sometimes.
Well, it's really, really interesting.
It is.
Well, thank you for coming.
You're welcome. Anytime.
That's reporter George Putich right here in our Washington studios. This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat.
Some residential lawns in California are getting an extreme makeover. The sod is being replaced by synthetic turf that its makers say is practically carefree. California is in its fourth year of a severe drought, prompting statewide water restrictions. Synthetic grass used to be just for golf courses or athletic fields, but many Americans love the look of lush green grass.
The product feels, looks, smells like real grass.
Peter Lord is with Chesapeake Bay Synthetic Landscapes, which sells Synlawn products.
And the water deficiency out there is so important. The state is offering up to $3 a square foot to help offset the cost of installing this.
Water-free lawns may be just a drop in the bucket to California's water woes, though. 80% of the state's water goes to agriculture, and farms are largely exempt from the new restrictions. I'm VOA's Rebecca Ward for Greenbeat.
Homeless young adults in Denver, Colorado, are given a second chance through a coffee shop that hires those making a transition from a life on the streets into their own homes. One of the employees spoke with Paula Vargas about how Purple Door Coffee Shop is helping make the transition.
Welcome. What can I get started for you guys?
For a quarter of his life, Kevin Person lived on the street. Today, he's working behind the counter of an espresso bar, serving coffee, and working to transition off the streets and into a home.
It's a struggle to get a job even when you have a house nowadays. But when you don't have a house, trying to get a job is so much harder.
It's made a little easier in Denver because of Purple Door Coffee. It does not just serve a cup of Java. It turns lives around. The owners of the two-year-old nonprofit hire 3 to 4 young adults per year, reaching out to shelters like Urban Peak, where Kevin was staying, for recommendations of those ready to commit to working. Kim Easton, who runs Urban Peak, says the partnership is vital to the struggling community.
When someone has lived in chronic stress and trauma for as long as these young people have, every day fighting for survival, they haven't had the opportunity nor the example of how to learn conflict management, how to manage money, how to cook a meal, how to pay their rent on time, nor do they understand even why that's important.
It's exactly what employment at Purple Door offers. Co-founder Madison Chandler and her partner meet with their workers individually each week to talk about 52 topics, from mental health and customer service to providing a life coach to ensure they have the support and skills that will set them up for success.
Right. So there's the teaching about things ranging from hygiene to budgeting to credit score to
like how to do laundry, things like that.
Chandler says at the end of Purple Door's first year, their four graduates were ready to start a new chapter in their lives, and the program helped them get jobs.
Our very first guy that ever graduated from the program, he's been working at an auto parts warehouse since he left, which has been over a year now.
Kevin recognizes that he is being given the tools to leave behind the struggles of homelessness and learn the skills needed to live a life full of color.
They seem to have the philosophy that they don't want to change us, they want to help us change ourselves.
For the first time in his life, Kevin, who says he is used to being kicked out of stores and treated with disrespect, is being trusted with money, handling food, and enjoying conversations with customers.
How are you doing today?
Yeah.
Doing very well. I love your purse. That is
in the short
awesome.
Time Kevin has been in the program, he says it's already given him the support, love, and opportunity he and many others without homes need but denied.
It's been so helpful just to have structure and to have, like, a purpose and a goal that's, like, tangible.
Denver is one of the 10 fastest-growing cities in the United States. It is also one of the top 10 major cities in numbers of its homeless. An official census on one night in January last year counted 5,812 men, women, and children staying in the city shelters or on the street. More than 500 were young adults on their own, like Kevin. For Chandler, providing these young adults with employment and education and helping them become confident and independent is the most rewarding part of her job.
Watching somebody start to believe in themselves and to believe that they can achieve a life for themselves that they've dreamed of, or to believe that they're worth it, even.
For Kevin, who is turning 25 this month, living off the streets, in a home, and having a job to come to will be the best gift he can give himself. For VOA News, Paula Vargas in Denver.
And is this for here, or to go? And two of those.
That's it for us today. We'll see you tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs, are chronic disabling illnesses that thrive in areas with poor sanitation, lack of clean drinking water, and scant access to medication. The World Health Organization has identified 17 of them as priorities for action. Some of them can be effectively treated and even eliminated with low-cost medications, in many cases donated by pharmaceutical companies. Getting these medications to where they are needed has been a daunting task, since these are diseases of the poorest of the poor. Their impact on individuals and communities can be devastating. NTDs impair intellectual development in children and reduce school enrollment. They limit the ability of infected individuals to work and thrive, thus trapping them in a cycle of poverty and disease. Today, over 1 billion people suffer from at least one NTD. In 2006, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, started a program addressing the seven diseases that comprise 80% of all NTDs: lymphatic filariasis, blinding trachoma, onchocerciasis, schistosomiasis, and the three most common infections, the soil-transmitted parasites hookworm, roundworm, and whipworm. Back then, the program had a budget of $15 million to distribute 36 million treatments to 16 million people in four countries, said USAID Assistant Administrator Ariel Pablos Mendez. Today, it's $100 million and 240 million treatments distributed to 115 million people in 31 countries. The program is very successful for three reasons. First is USAID's partnership with the pharmaceutical sector, which has to date contributed $8.8 billion worth of medication. Second is USAID's partnership and coordination with the government of the United Kingdom's Department for International Development, which has allowed for a collective reach to almost 50 countries and the provision of 340 million treatments in 2014. And third, USAID's cooperation with host governments and the ability to build upon the existing infrastructure of national disease control and elimination programs. The elimination of these diseases of extreme poverty as a public health scourge is within our grasp, said USAID Assistant Administrator Pablos Mendez. USAID is committed to working with countries and our global partners to reach the remaining 800 million people who still need treatment.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.